This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. These are very exciting times to be following world news in light of the prophecies of the Bible. Surveying the events of this past week gives us a lot to talk about, so we're going to dive right in. We have our panel of trumpet writers here, eager to share their insights. Here in the studio, we have Andrew Miller.
Great to be here. We'll be talking a lot about a big foreign policy change in the Obama administration, and then also about a U.S. judge who wants to scrap the Constitution.
We also have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you. I'll be talking about Vladimir Putin's visit to Beijing this week and what it means for the Russia-China alliance.
Via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon. The Austrian High Court has apparently decided we've not had enough European crises this week, so today they decided to give us another.
And via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Nachtigall.
Hello, good to be here. I'll be talking about the strategy that ISIS is now employing in the region through terrorist attacks.
Every week, the staff of the Trumpet Magazine produces a free digest of the most important news of the week called the Trumpet Weekly. You can visit thetrumpet.com to become a subscriber. It's absolutely free of charge. This week's edition, the cover story is Brad McDonald's article, Brexit Exposes UK's Many Infirmities. It's an excellent article, really going point by point down the problems facing Britain today in the aftermath of its decision last Thursday to leave the European Union. I'd highly encourage you to read that article. We talked on Wednesday's program about some of those internal problems within Britain and the ramifications of that referendum last week. We're going to start the show today by talking about what's happening across the English Channel and how Europe is responding to Brexit. This is absolutely amazing what is happening here when looked at through the lens of biblical prophecy. Stephen Fleury has been covering quite a lot of this on his Trumpet Daily radio show. But to give us an overview of several headlines out of Europe this week, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard.
Well, we're just over a week out from the Brexit vote, but already there's some very interesting developments coming out. I'd say so far, Europe's response to Brexit revolves around three main areas, three main ideas. One is that a core group of European nations needs to move towards more integration. A second is that there's a strong focus on a military union. And then the third is there's a crying out now for charismatic leadership, especially within Germany. So just kind of taking some of those one at a time.
These are really three trends that could not be more significant from a prophetic standpoint.
Absolutely. We've been looking for these for years, and it is quite stunning to see them all. Well, I mean, in a way, it's not surprising. Brexit was a big deal, but it's very exciting, I should say, to see all three of these coming out so clearly so soon after that vote. So one of the most significant events this week was the foreign ministers from France and Germany. They wrote kind of their joint, they laid out their joint response to the Brexit vote in a paper that they published on Monday. This paper made quite a lot of big headlines, including the top banner on the Drudge Report. And their key theme.
Now, is this the report that was delayed until after the Brexit vote that they'd been working on for a while?
This is not. We will get to that, actually.
Okay.
That was by Federica Mogherini. That one has not yet been published in full, but the Daily Express has been publishing excerpts from that. I think we're expecting that paper to be published next week. But this one was a specific response to the Brexit vote. And what these two said was, we need to take further steps towards a political union in Europe. So they want to push forward. At the same time, though, the two foreign ministers, they also said that we must acknowledge there are different degrees of ambition towards further integration among the member states. And another very prominent German politician, the finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, he said very much the same thing. Germany needs to recognize that if people don't want to push forward towards integration, that they're not bad Europeans. And it's quite a logical response to the the Brexit vote. On the one hand, to be a cohesive body, to kind of get out of this halfway house between, you know, being halfway towards a super state that we talked about last week, they need to move forward towards a political union. On the other hand, getting 27 nations to move forward towards political union is a tall order. So this is a logical response to that. They're not the only ones calling for it, particularly the CSU within Germany. They had a couple of key people there, like the Vice Chancellor Sigmar Gabriel, European Parliament President Martin Schulz. They published a paper entitled Refound Europe. So a lot of people saying we need to rethink Europe now. And the big idea to rethink Europe is a much, much more closely integrated set of nations, while a second set sit on the outside. And German Foreign Policy wrote that these would be subordinated to second-class status.
So we've been looking for the reduction of a 27, 28-member European Union to come down to 10 core members. That's definitely seems to be at play here. You also mentioned military union.
Right, and this was one in that position paper that those two foreign ministers laid out. They laid out three areas where this smaller group could push forward. And the first and most important of these was towards a military union. So they made a number of concrete recommendations. They wanted Europe to come up with a common security and defense policy. They wanted Europe to have an employable high readiness forces. They wanted to establish standing maritime forces. So you're starting to look, I mean, you put that in plain English, European Army, European Navy. Now, it wouldn't be a gigantic leap where suddenly all of these nations would hand over all of their armed forces, but it's still a very significant step. They also talked about working on procurement together so that Europe starts to fill some of those gaps that it has as a whole. So, and then a permanent chain of command as well. So these are major changes for Europe. This is talking about making Europe a major security player.
Now, this is something that it's obviously been talked about, trying to create a European army for some time. We've talked about these developments for a while, these discussions. What is it about Britain's decision to leave that has put these front and center again? Is it just the fact that the break that they applied to trying to create a European Union is gone, and so now they can proceed forward with greater speed?
I'd say it's three things. Firstly, it's that a lot of these plans were delayed, like you mentioned, until after Brexit. And so we mentioned briefly Federica Mogherini's paper. This called for the same kind of thing in the leaks that we've seen from that so far, a credible European defense. You know, Europeans need to take greater responsibility for our security. So that was delayed until after Brexit. Only a tiny group of people were allowed to see it. Now that's getting spread more widely, and so bits of that are leaking out. The second is that Europe is now less powerful as a military now that Britain is gone. If you kind of take a pan-European military, Britain is one of the biggest spenders on military. And so without Britain, that leaves kind of a hole. And so people are saying, well, we need to fill this. So, for example, Hans-Peter Bartels, he has a German politician and has a senior role in the parliament in dealing with defense matters. He talks about how Germany has even more responsibility. European security policy will now rely more on France and Germany. And so there's a view now that Europe needs to step up now that Britain has left. And then finally, as you said, Britain was a break on that. Now that break has been removed. Before, there was no point talking too much about military and defense because people always knew Britain was going to veto it. That can't happen anymore.
Okay, so we talked about the reduction of a large multi-state union down to a small core. We've talked about the development of a military. The third trend that you mentioned at the beginning was the call for stronger leadership.
That's right. There's a Foreign Policy had a great article called Britain's Departure from the EU Has Made Germany Far More Powerful Than It Should Be. And it pointed out that Germany now suddenly has this much bigger new role within the European Union. Britain not being there gives Germany more power. Add to that, Europe now is kind of in a crisis. What are we here for? And they're looking to Germany. And Germany doesn't really have someone there who can give the vision and the impetus that, that Europe needs. This article in Foreign Policy talks about how Ms. Merkel has no master plan to keep the EU from unraveling and about how Europe needs remodeling and a fresh source of inspiration. And Spiegel had a similar article. I mean, they said this is what Europe needs following Brexit. Goosebumps. They need a charismatic leader who can rally Europeans around, who can paint a vision of what Europe should be, who can give a speech that gets shared 10 million times on YouTube, that young people can really rally behind and say, yes, this leader gets it. But that leader is not Ms. Merkel. I don't know whether she's ever given some kind of inspiring visionary speech in her life. She is a very competent leader. She's proven that over her time in power. She's not a visionary and she's not a charismatic leader. And there's a lot of people now realizing this is what Europe needs, a charismatic leader, someone who can really stir people's emotions.
Fascinating, fascinating stuff. We appreciate that, Richard. So much dynamite material in this week's Trumpet Weekly. We're really just scratching the surface here. I would encourage any listener to go online to thetrumpet.com and read the articles that we're talking about here. We're going to go travel west now across, the much larger body of water on the other side of the British Isles. We're going to see how America is responding to Britain's vote to leave the EU. And for this story, we'll go to Andrew.
Yes, well, yeah, definitely. Britain's vote to leave the European Union is hastening a trend in American foreign policy. We've actually seen for about a decade now of looking increasingly to Germany as your ally of preference. It's not necessarily a new thing. I think there have been high-level officials in the Obama administration from the very beginning who've talked about Germany like America's best friend, which was quite a snub to Britain, actually, because, I mean, before that, especially like under the George Bush administration and even more so under the Ronald Reagan administration, they talked about the special relationship or the relationship between America and Britain. And with Britain and the European Union, America's really has for their relationship they do have with Britain kind of looked at them like the man on the inside for trying to get stuff done in the European Union, which they can't do anymore if Britain's out. So we'd brought attention a few weeks back about comments President Barack Obama himself had made before the Brexit referendum. They're saying, well, if you choose to leave, you're going to the back of the queue in terms of trade preferences. We'll be dealing with Germany and the European Union as our primary trade partners. And Obama's been a little more careful not to burn all his bridges since Brexit, but there are still very, very many key officials in government advisory positions that are making some pretty strong claims. And we've got a pretty good long list of those in our Trumpet Weekly this week. But one of them that comes to mind is Nicholas Burns, who's was a former foreign policy advisor for the Bush administration. He's advising the Hillary Clinton campaign now. But his comment is, Henry Kissinger's famous question about who do I call in Europe has now been settled. The answer is we call the German Chancellor's office. That means we have to invest in our relationship with Germany.
It's a stunning quote.
Right, yeah, because that was, and I guess for not knowing anyone who may not be familiar with Henry Kissinger's quote, this is a quote he made several decades back where he was talking about a united Europe, and he's like, says, well, there isn't really a united Europe. He said, if I want to get a hold of Europe, who do I call? He said, if I want to get a hold of the Soviet Union, you know who to call, or to China, you know who to call, but like, who do you call to talk to Europe?
And this is before we've even seen the emergence of this charismatic leader that Richard was talking about.
Right, he's talking about Angela Merkel, and we just spent a good amount of time how she's really not up to the task of leading all Europe. So when that charismatic leader emerges, it'd be interesting to see their relationship with the United States in the early days.
Well, we definitely have been looking for the fulfillment of prophecies directly talking about the relationship between the United States and Germany and the way that the United States would be pursuing that relationship, even to its own detriment, certainly heedless of any potential danger in that relationship. So we're really seeing that lurch forward, aren't we?
Right. I mean, even historically in the European Union, even in the early days in the 50s, they said probably about half of the funding they used to get that project off of its feet came from the U.S. State Department. So we've been involved in building this power block from the very beginning, kind of heedless as to what dangers could exist of actually building a world power block just as powerful or more powerful than you are.
Yeah, just to bring in one, go back to what I was saying about rebuilding Europe's military in the wake of Brexit. America is really pushing that. And I just wanted to read one quick quote from that article in the Trumpet Weekly to show, like Andrew was saying, that America really is building this power up. And this is from a paper written by Ambassador Burns and a general. Germany must take the lead in this recovery of Europe's military strength. So as part of this looking for Germany, they now want Germany to build the military so that they can replace Britain as America's number one military partner too. And there are a whole bunch of quotes in this section of the Trumpet Weekly about America encouraging that.
So this referendum by Britain, this was really one of the most dramatic fulfillments of prophecy that we have seen in quite a number of years. But wow, it is awesome to watch what's happening in its wake and all of the ripple effects and the ramifications of this decision that really are palpably accelerating the fulfillment of several other key prophecies that we keep our eyes on. So we'll continue to watch this, and you got to keep your eyes on thetrumpet.com, and we will continue to bring you reportage on the most significant of those developments. Well, thanks for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. Other huge news this week, a surge in terrorist attacks by the Islamic State, including a massive coordinated attack in Turkey that killed 42 people, but also attacks in Israel, in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Jordan. Our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal, spoke about this on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show this morning. It's a fascinating program. If you have the opportunity to listen to that, I'd encourage you to do so. But I want to give Brent the opportunity, if you can, Brent, to summarize the conclusions that you drew in that hour-long program and how these attacks could really accelerate the fulfillment of some other important prophecies.
Yeah, that's a pretty tall order. but it is very interesting looking back, and even the past 3 weeks, we had three terrorist attacks. I didn't really get into it in this way during the Trumpet Daily program this morning. But the first one that was kind of different from the way ISIS normally attacks is one that they did at the Jordanian border. Jordan obviously borders Syria to the north, and that border hadn't really came too much under attack of late. And right now they kind of had this no man's land on the other side of the Jordanian border, where there is a small gap where a lot of refugees can seek safe haven between Syria main proper and Jordan proper. And ISIS, with a car load full of explosives, drove right into this no man's land past the military post and exploded that, which shut down the Jordanian border to all Syrian refugees. Huge. It was massive. It's creating a humanitarian disaster down there. So that was the first sign that they were doing something new. And then we had the huge attack that took place at the Ataturk International Airport in Istanbul, the highest profile target that ISIS could have struck in Turkey. They struck on Tuesday night, killing 44 people. Extremely well planned. Three suicide bombers at three different times exploding themselves in ways to try and catch the public as they ran from one explosion, ran away from one explosion to another. Another one would go off to try and get those running away. It's come out that they were from ISIS as well, from Raqqa. They came to the capital of the Islamic State in Syria, but they came to Turkey a month ago to set up this attack. And then the final attack, which this is different for ISIS as well. They haven't sought such a high-profile target in Turkey as yet. So this is a new avenue for them. And then the final one that I talked about in the program this morning was an attack that didn't meet much press because not too many people were killed, but there was a contagion of eight suicide bombers, one after the other, on the border of northern Lebanon, as ISIS fighters from Raqqa, again, headquarters of Islamic State, they were sent there on this mission, tried to infiltrate Lebanon and tried to cause attacks there. Now, the caliphate of ISIS that they're trying to grow in Syria, in Iraq. That was kind of their main goal originally, was to create this large swath of land that they could control and declare their state. Now, there have been a number of losses of late, and people are saying that that's what's causing them to change their modus operandi. That might be the case, but whatever the case, they are changing how they act. They're not necessarily going after more or a larger piece of land anymore. They're trying to infiltrate these countries on the border of Iraq and Syria to try and get them involved in this fight.
Can you just summarize how this could affect and influence and provoke the fulfillment of more biblical prophecies?
Right. So the biggest prophecy we're looking at is for countries, the country of Syria and also Lebanon, to fall out of favor with Iran. We know through the prophecy in Daniel 11, verse 40 to 43, that there's a few nations that are aligned with Iran. And we know from Psalm 83 that there's other nations that are aligned against Iran or not a part of the Iranian alliance. Right now, we have Syria and Lebanon that are allied with Iran, and yet prophecy says they will not be. And that's big. And what I believe could be the way that this happens is that if ISIS does start taking the fight to Hezbollah inside Lebanon, that you're going to have a lot of the Lebanese public that get upset with the 6% of the country, which are Shia. The rest of them aren't. The rest of them don't want to be involved in this war. And a lot of the Shia inside Lebanon don't want to be involved in this war. But Hezbollah has dragged them into it. So ISIS feels like if I can fight in their backyard, where their home is, that maybe they will be withdrawn from the Syrian conflict, or maybe that will cause them to think twice. I'm not sure how it's going to play out necessarily, but we know that ISIS is doing something different inside Lebanon, and it is going to get a reaction against Hezbollah in their homeland.
What makes it all so interesting is, to this point, you've seen Iran play the game so well in using the Islamic State's activities as a means of creating its own advantage in some of these theaters of interest for it. I thought you did a great job this morning of just talking about that with respect to ISIS's activities in Syria, in Lebanon, and creating this this corridor of control that goes out to the Mediterranean, but how that's being challenged now, and you could see that unfolding in a way that would break these nations loose from that that Iranian orbit. So definitely something to watch closely, because it doesn't always unfold the way that we expect it to, but we do have enough of an understanding of the ultimate outcome that it really does make it interesting.
Well, I think that's even the case with Brexit. When we were looking at that, we knew that Britain was not going to be a part of the EU. Do they leave? Do they get kicked out? Big argument, well, not argument, but debate that we've had, at the trumpet. How is it going to happen? But we knew the end result. And this is what we know with this as well. How it's going to happen, we can only speculate, yet the end result is assured.
Fascinating stuff. Well, thanks for that, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We have one more story before the break. We're going to Asia now, one of the most significant trends in biblical prophecy we're seeing develop before our eyes is the creation of an Asian alliance centered around ties between Russia and China. And while there's a lot of evidence of this happening, there have been some analysts saying that it's actually not as significant as it might appear. One observer this week, though, says, no, the alliance developing here is actually extremely significant. And to tell us about this, we'll turn to our Asia analyst, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Russian President Vladimir Putin made his fifth visit to Beijing this week in another sign of those rapidly growing ties between Russia and China. And it's interesting because back in 2014, when China and Russia were really leaning toward each other and making just long lists of huge deals, analysts could not deny that a Russia-China alliance had arrived. And it was evident to everyone that the two were forging ties of unprecedented strength and depth. But then, under the pressure of sanctions from the US and Europe, Russia's economy really started to struggle. And that struggle prompted many Western analysts, as you said, to begin to think that the Russo-Chinese alliance was not actually as robust as they had initially thought, and that the partnership was largely hype and propaganda from Moscow and Beijing, and just kind of deceptively shallow. But in the Trumpet Weekly this week, we've published part of an article from a publication called War on the Rocks. It's written by Alexander Gabuev. He's the chair of the Russia in the Asia-Pacific program at the Carnegie Moscow Center. And Gabuev does an excellent job of challenging that sort of new Western view and showing that despite Russia's economic trouble and despite some exaggeration from Moscow and Beijing, the partnership between Russia and China is still a really formidable one and one that is growing more and more significant. I'll just read a quote from his article here. Poking holes in Russian and Chinese propaganda may be worthwhile, but not if it lulls outside observers into missing the fact that Moscow is slowly but surely drifting into Beijing's embrace. The Kremlin's pivot to Asia is happening under challenging external conditions, a fact that should be taken into account when measuring its progress. Russian-Chinese trade fell by nearly 30% in 2015, largely due to the collapse in oil prices, but the actual volume of Russian oil exports to China increased by the same amount. So for the first time in history, Moscow has become the largest crude supplier to Beijing, which puts them basically on par with Saudi Arabia. And now Russia and China are expanding the pipelines that connect their energy networks. So it's a powerful assessment there and a sobering one from Gabuev. He just powerfully proves, I think, that even though the Russian economy is definitely not in the position that it hoped it would be in a few years ago right now, after having been hit by those sanctions have actually forced deeper cooperation with China. So rather than causing a crushing blow that the West had hoped to do with those sanctions, they served instead as kind of a catalyst that only congeals the relationship between those two nations.
I'm sure you'd have to look at falling oil prices as well as being a real blow to the Russian economy. But is there any other evidence of the strength of this alliance that he points to?
Well, there is. He says that another major aspect of it is that up until 2014, 2015, Russia had always been very reluctant to share military technology with China. They'd always been afraid that that technology would be reverse engineered and that the Chinese could possibly end up even using it against Russia. But now all of that reluctance has dissolved. And we've seen suddenly Russia is selling China highly advanced systems like the S-400 surface-to-air missile system and the Su-35 fighter jets, and all of these deals are likely to really alter the strategic balance vis-a-vis Taiwan, the East China Sea, the South China Sea, things like that. So,
growing Russian comfort with the idea of even a military alliance between these two countries, possibly.
That's right. Just a lot less concern that China could use those weapons against them, or if that concern does remain, then it's trumped by the desire to form this alliance.
Very good. Well, thanks for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about the political tumult in Austria, more developments in the relationship between China and Taiwan. We'll go back to Turkey and look at its ties with Israel and Russia. And we'll also look at the fact that a majority of Democrats don't want Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump for president. They want a third term for Barack Obama. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Some wild political news out of Austria. This past May, Austria had a presidential election in which the right-wing nationalist candidate was just barely beaten. We reported on that at the time. Well, now the nation's constitutional court has invalidated the election result and says that election needs to be rerun. To talk about what this means, we're going to go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yes, we've had Brexit. Is Austria now about to become Austria? The far right, or the candidate, Norbert Hofer, from the kind of the fringe right wing party, has very strong Eurosceptic leanings. And he came within 0.3% of winning that election. Then the Austrian court, just today, they announced that that election was invalidated. They said that thousands of votes were postal votes were opened too early, some by people unauthorized to do so. And then the Hofer's party claimed that they had evidence that some under 16s and some foreigners had been allowed to vote. The court said that these violations didn't affect the outcome. However, they've ruled a revote, and that will now be held in September or October. And this is not when you want an election, especially right, not a close election like this for Europe.
The timing is very interesting here.
Yeah, they were already reeling from the Brexit vote. To add to that, what we've not really talked about and what would have been probably plastered all over the Europe section of the Trumpet Weekly had it not been for Brexit is Italy's banks look like they're right on the brink of a meltdown. There have been all kinds of behind-the-scenes maneuvering over the last week to try and set up bailout funds in place. Italy's banks have got so much debt that could bring the Italian state down, which would then bring the euro crisis just to a whole new level. So this is something that could explode during the summer. Deutsche Bank, a report this week as well, exposing serious trouble there. So you've got so many, and then you've got the immigration crisis that could come up during the summer. So this could be a big summer for Europe. And then right at the end of that, they've got this election, and then they've got Austria, a key Central European country, and any of these events could well propel then this, or would influence this incredibly close vote, and you could have a far right leader, as many people see it, in charge of a Western European country.
It's really amazing how much of a difference 4 months can make for a state in Europe. I mean, all of these crises that you're describing, a Brexit just being, say, the top of the list, but all of these others that could impact that election when it was such a razor-thin margin, really extraordinary.
Yeah, it's definitely something to keep an eye on. In some ways, I don't know which way the Brexit would have shifted the vote. In Spain, they had an election shortly afterwards, and it seemed to shift things in favor more of the pro-Europeans. But with such a thin, razor-thin margin, nobody can be at all certain of the outcome of that vote.
Well, thanks for that, Richard. We'll keep our eye on that and look forward to the results of that election this coming fall. We're going to go back to Asia now and look at developments in the relationship between China and Taiwan. Taiwan's new president has turned away from China. We've been watching to see how China is going to respond to that. For news of this, we'll turn to Jeremiah.
Yes, the Trumpet has been keeping a close eye on Tsai Ing-wen, that's Taiwan's new president, ever since she was elected in a landslide victory back on January 16th of this year. We've been saying that it could prompt some really big changes in the relationship between Taiwan and China. And now this week, quite a significant development happened when China announced that it has suspended all diplomatic contact with Taiwan. So just for a little bit of backstory, the relationship between Taiwan and China has been tense pretty much for as long as the two have existed as separate nations. That started back in 1949 after a violent civil war divided them into two. And ever since then, China has claimed that Taiwan is just sort of a rogue state. And China has often vowed to use force to put Taiwan officially under Beijing's control. But then in 1992, the two sides agreed to both endorse something called the One China Principle. And that basically just means that they both agreed to view themselves as two parts of one single country, even though each one holds quite a different interpretation of exactly what that means. But ever since they made this agreement, agreed to endorse this One China Principle, it brought a measure of stability to their rocky relationship. It wasn't always totally smooth sailing, but it did bring some stability. And then that stability and smoothness improved quite a lot under Tsai's immediate predecessor. His name was Ma Ying-jeou, and he served as Taiwan's president from 2008 until the beginning of this year. Ma was very submissive to China. He did basically whatever Beijing told him to do.
We had been talking about just how likely it was that Taiwan would come under China's control, and it looked like that would be a pretty smooth transition, but then things got tipped over on their head.
Yes, exactly. Under Ma, it looked like it would happen voluntarily almost, that Taiwan would just say, okay, you know what, we are part of China once again. But now, with this new president in there, the situation has totally reversed. She's in office, and she was elected based on promises to sort of cease and desist all of that kowtowing that her predecessor had done. And now she's making good on those promises. She's refused to endorse this one China principle. She's also refused to disavow calls for full-blown Taiwanese independence. So on June 25th, Beijing released this statement saying the cross-strait communication mechanism has been suspended because Taiwan did not recognize that 1992 consensus, the One China Principle. So now we have a situation in which Beijing is either forced to accept that Taiwan is now on a path of very assertive independence, or take some kind of action to put Taiwan back in line.
Right. Well, considering all of its activities, its military activities in that part of the world, and just how it's really building up its military in the South China Sea, you'd have to think that it has plenty of tools at its disposal if it did want to bring Taiwan to heel using more robust methods.
Yes. One really important detail here, as you said, if there were a confrontation between China and Taiwan alone, China would have no trouble at all conquering the island. But America weighs heavily into this equation. The U.S. has always promised to come to Taiwan's aid in the event of such a confrontation. But now, though, China, just like the rest of the world, has seen the U.S. being exposed over and over again as an unreliable ally and as a nation that's afraid to use its power in any meaningful way. So the combination of these two things, China seeing the U.S. as an unreliable ally and China seeing Taiwan suddenly refusing to do what Beijing says, means that Beijing really could decide to take some kind of action to rein Taiwan in.
Again, another situation to keep our eye on. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We're going to go back now to Turkey. 6 months ago, Turkey shot down a Russian fighter jet, and that caused relations between these two countries to break. We spoke on Wednesday's program about the new deal that Turkey forged with Israel. And Brent Nachtigall is going to bring us more information about the reemergence of Turkey's relations, not only with Israel, but now also with Russia.
Yeah, it's a very big move this week, and even later on this afternoon as well. There looks like Russia and Turkey are becoming a whole lot more close than they've been in recent times. Like you said, ever since Turkey shot down that jet, Russian jet, and didn't apologize for it. Now, this has put Turkey in a pretty bad situation, even as we talked about on Wednesday, just because Russia is the largest importer of Turkish goods. They have the biggest trade relationship exists from Turkey to Russia. It's their biggest trading partner. So to lose a lot of that really hurt Turkey economically, and Erdogan, the president there, mustn't have been doing too well, and that probably is what pushed him to accept the deal with Israel as well. But it's gone further than just Erdogan apologizing, choosing this week to apologize to Putin for shooting down that jet. Recently, even this afternoon, Turkey has agreed to work together with Russia in forging ahead towards a political solution in Syria. This is huge for a number of years. Turkey has been the lead in as far as Middle Eastern states against the rule, taking the lead against the rule of Assad. And at the very beginning of the Syrian civil war, you had a lot of Turkmen that live in northern Syria being bombed by the Syrian dictator. And this obviously upset Erdogan quite a lot. And for that reason, he allowed Islamic State fighters to just be, you know, Turkey to be the transit point for them from all the foreign fighters. They flew into Ataturk Airport, then they drove down to the border, came across into Syria, and set up their shop with the Islamic State. That's how numbers of the Islamic State grew so much. And so Turkey was vehemently against Assad. And yet we have this week, even today, Turkey coming full circle from where they were a week ago and even where they were years ago to say to Russia, it's time to work together for a political solution in Syria.
So saying political solution, you're talking about preserving the Assad regime.
Yes, exactly. Well, let's talk about that a little bit. Whether that means preserving the Assad regime, it definitely means preserving the Syrian institutions, the Syrian state as it exists today. Whether or not Turkey has come to some agreement with Russia that Assad is going to leave eventually. Like I said in the program today, Russia doesn't care whether Assad goes or stays. They care whether their influence in Syria stays. And if the next leader can say that, yes, we're happy with you having your naval port here with your air base here, that's fine, they would be happy for Assad to leave. And yet Turkey's main beef is with Assad. So I'm just speculating here, but it seems like Turkey and Erdogan have eaten a lot of humble pie this week. And as far as we can tell, they haven't really gotten anything for it yet. And maybe there is a political solution that going forward in Syria that doesn't include Assad. We'll see. I mean, nobody's really saying that just yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if that happens.
Just help us, if you can, to put this in context for Turkey to be making this kind of an about face, not only with Russia, but also with Israel. I mean, it definitely, as we as talked about on Wednesday, shows just how weakened its position has become. But how can we expect this to play out going forward?
It's very interesting because Turkey, as we said before, has been backed into a corner here to accept at least the deal with Israel, and probably no one wants to apologize for doing something like shooting down somebody that was in your airspace that shouldn't have been there. But they were forced to do that for some reason. But like I said, they must be getting something out of it. Again, just putting it in context of how much this is a turnaround. The Syrian civil war wouldn't have been I'm not going to say it wouldn't have happened necessarily because it was caused by Assad shooting and killing his own people. But the rebels, the response of the Islamic State, the fact that the Syrian dictator hasn't been able to defeat them is because of Turkey. And yet now they are choosing to agree with Russia, who has fought against Turkey, Turkey's proxies down in Syria. So I can't speculate too much of how this is going to play out, but something big is happening right now across the Middle East, and it's got Russia's fingerprints all over it. Now, we're looking for Europe to get involved. When is Europe going to get involved in this theater? They're a member of NATO, or Turkey's a member of NATO. We have we had this deal with Turkey and the rest of Europe earlier this year that they were going to stop all the migrants from coming in if the European Union allowed certain gifts to Turkey, if you like, cash and visa-free travel into Europe. And yet that's all gone silent, and we see Russia now rising as the Middle Eastern mediator. And yet we've got to see Europe come in. I'm not sure how Europe's going to come in just yet, but it looks like this Syrian civil war might be coming to an end. And that is interesting because Mr. Gerald Flurry said at the beginning of the Syrian civil war that at the end of this civil war, we are going to have changes in the alliances in the Middle East that's going to rock the world. That's what he said 5 years ago. And if it comes to an end here in the next little bit, I mean, it's going to be stunning to see where these nations fall as far as their alliances go.
Excellent question. What is Europe going to do? It seems like just witnessing the position that Turkey has found itself in, that there would be European leaders who would be very interested in taking advantage of that situation and exploiting Turkey's weakness in order to extend its own influence into the region. Turkey's such a strategically, geographically important country, as well as militarily. So definitely you need to keep us apprised of this and keep your eye on that. Tell us how this situation develops. For our last major story in the program today, we're going to come back to the United States. As I said, we saw an interesting poll this week describing the desire of Democrats for an alternative to Clinton and Trump in this year's presidential race. But before we get to that, we're going to look at some terrible comments from a federal judge this week that could point to, well, maybe how those Democrats might get their wish. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew.
Yeah, this was one of the most shocking commentaries I've ever seen. It was published on Slate's website last Friday by a judge on the Seventh Court of Appeals, Richard Posner.
And you can always count on Slate.
Always Slate.
To give
always
us those shocking commentaries.
Right. They find these guys, but no, this isn't just some obscure guy, Richard Posner. I mean, he is a federal judge on the Seventh Court of Appeals, and this is what he wrote. He said, "I see absolutely no value to a judge of spending decades, years, months, weeks, days, hours, minutes, or even seconds studying the Constitution, the history of its enactments, its amendments, and its implementation. 18th century guys, however smart, could not foresee the culture, technology, etc. of the 21st century." Which I think one of the main reasons that stood out to me is we've got a small group here within the editorial departments that's been spending an hour every Wednesday basically studying all those things that Richard Posner says that people shouldn't study.
Right. But we're studying them even more than that and having a really good, robust discussion every Wednesday about it for an hour. And you have to kind of take this personally, don't you, as an American?
This is the government this is the legal systems that's allowed him to be a judge on the Seventh Court. There would be no Seventh Circuit Court if it wasn't for the Constitution. And also, one of the most amazing things about that document is just how short it is. I mean, if you look at like the Constitution of the European Union, I mean, 300 pages.
Yeah.
It's enormous. And you could see how, after 200 years, that Constitution will probably be kind of dated. But the American Constitution is just a handful of pages, mostly about human nature, the one thing that doesn't change. Technology changes, cultures change, human nature doesn't change. And so it's basically one document, doesn't really get into people's lives, just have a few universal principles limiting the power of the government in people's lives to preserve freedom. And that never becomes outdated.
What struck me as we've been studying this and discussing it is just how relevant it is today, and how much, if the government had stuck to its principles, or if it actually had the respect for those principles that it should have, and that judges like the one that you're describing promised to do,
right,
promised to defend, that we would be a whole lot better off than we are.
Yeah, he took an oath to defend the Constitution when you become a judge, and 100 years ago he'd be facing impeachment trials in Congress for a statement like this. But today, it is something that has become, this is not uncommon. You hear this from political pundits all the time, especially on like Second Amendment or now even like Fifth Amendment, that defends people's right to trial by jury. And that is kind of like our lead into this second story I wanted to bring, where they did a poll this week that found that 67% of the Democrat Party members they polled said that they would support a third term for President Obama before they'd be willing to see either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump become president. And that is a bit of a statement to just how popular both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are.
Right.
And granted, I will admit the sample size on the study says it had that 67% has about a 5% margin of error, according to the techniques they did for that study. But the sample size was low, like less than 400 people. So I don't know if that's a conclusive evidence that there really are more than half of the Democratic Party who would like to see a third term for Obama, but it is pretty good evidence that there's at least a significant number of people, and not that I'm predicting like anything like that would happen, but it is just very relevant, especially in light of this judge's previous comment, just how little regard there is for the fact that we have an amendment limiting a president to two terms.
Right. Well, this is a trend that we've followed quite a lot. Gerald Fleury has talked about this a lot, just how much contempt there is for the Constitution today and for the rule of law, how little regard so many in public office, in the media, in commentators, how little regard they have for the rule of law in the country, and how willing they would be to discard those kinds of laws and prescriptions by the Constitution. Of course, the two-term limit was enshrined in one of the amendments of the Constitution. But right up until Franklin Delano Roosevelt, no one had more than two terms. It wasn't necessary, but it followed the pattern that was established by George Washington, the first president of the United States, to limit their time in office to two terms. But the whole idea is that we don't want a king. Right. We don't want someone in office who's going to just keep
and
on.
You said that George Washington arguably had the public support at the time that he could have been the king. He could have replaced George III as George I of the American, if he wanted to do that. He stepped down because he didn't want to set a precedent of people who cling to power for life. And then for like 150 years after that, people followed his example. And then eventually around World War II, we had to a president take four terms, so we kind of had to set this in an amendment that no, let's just as limit it to two. It will preserve our republic.
It raises some fascinating questions when you think about just what happens to a people that has that much contempt for the documents that really have established this country and given it so much stability and freedom for so long, and you see the erosions of those freedoms just happening with astonishing rapidity today, and people apparently don't seem to be all that concerned about it. Well, thank you, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we've been talking about on the program today are in this week's edition. We'd encourage you to get that and read it. We'll finish up the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
It's time now for our lightning round. We're going to take one last look at some of the headlines from this past week that caught our attention. We'll start with Andrew.
Yes, we had the Three Amigos Summit on Wednesday, and I'm not being sarcastic. That's really what it's called. But this is where President Obama meets with the leaders of Canada and Mexico for the three North American countries to mainly discuss free trade between the two countries. But this week, they also really put a big emphasis on Brexit and what that's going to future for that and U.S. trade relations.
We'll go now to Jeremiah.
The North Korean government has mobilized armies of children to forage for wild greens in the mountains and fields to be given to the nation's soldiers. These wild edibles are intended to offset the country's persistent food shortages. And so basically the government is just forcing middle school and high school students to spend long days finding these plants. And anyone who fails to find the requisite amount every day are forced to make cash contributions to the government. And if you know how poor these people are, you know that that's not really an option for most citizens of North Korea. So it's just a very sad reality and just another dark aspect of the slow motion nightmare that is North Korea.
Yeah, about five disturbing aspects of that story. We'll go now to Brent.
There were three terrorist attacks against Jews in Israel in the past 2 days. Yesterday in the coastal city of Netanya, two people were stabbed, and then another yesterday where a 13-year-old girl was stabbed to death by a Palestinian intruder in her bedroom. And then another one later today where a man was shot while driving. His wife was wounded, and his two sons were wounded as well. He ended up dying. So that is continuing. And Israel, meanwhile, in Iran, Al-Quds Day or Jerusalem Day was celebrated by tens of thousands of people marching in the streets. And in the middle of one of the squares was a replica of the Statue of Liberty with a Star of David on its head. And that was set ablaze. All the while, people shouted, "Death to Israel and America."
All right, we'll go now to Richard.
A quick update on British politics. Finally, some good news post-Brexit. Michael Gove is in the running now for Prime Minister. I mean, obviously, we don't take sides in politics, but we do feel it with this a bit like you might feel if, say, Brett Stevens or Charles Krauthammer was in the running to be the Republican leader. He has been very combative in taking on the left-wing establishment. He was apparently livid about the Iran deal because he saw it as a catastrophic appeasement. Now, as Mr. McDonald's article on the cover of the Trumpet Weekly brings out, he's not going to fix Britain's problems. To be honest, I think he's probably too right-wing to get the job. But that completely upended British politics this week and sunk former London Mayor Boris Johnson's bid for Prime Minister. And then the Labour Party descended into even more of an absolute shambles. The leader, Jeremy Corbyn, lost a vote of no confidence from about 170 votes to around 40. However, the vote is non-binding and he's refusing to leave. The party's also had another anti-Semitism row, and it looks like it could just split the whole party and there might be a new opposition party in Britain.
All right, Richard, put your pom-poms down now. We'll go now to, back to Jeremiah.
Rodrigo Duterte was sworn in as president of the Philippines this week, and while some hope that his maverick style will energize the country, others fear that he will destabilize it with a campaign to kill criminals en masse. He really was elected largely on his promises to cleanse the Philippines of criminals within 6 months by doing these extrajudiciary executions. And this pledge was welcomed by many crime-weary Filipinos, but it has alarmed a lot of human rights groups.
All right, we'll finish with Andrew.
Yesterday, the U.S. military announced that it will be lifting its ban on transgender individuals to serve in the armed services. This is practically the last ban that it looks like they'll have to lift. So they've already lifted the ban on women, homosexuals, and illegal immigrants to serve in the military. So now that transgenders will be phased into the U.S. Armed Services over the next year, it appears that children are the only class of humans who are still currently banned from military service.
Well, criminals, maybe they could pull the people from the prisons. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com, and we will give you a free subscription to the Trumpet Weekly. That's the weekly news report that we will send right to your email inbox. The stories that we talked about on the program today are in this week's edition. You can email us at letters@thetrumpet.com if you want to give us feedback on the show today. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Pleasure to be with you.
Great to be here.
Great to be here.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. I'll leave you with the words of George Washington. Happily, the government of the United States, which gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, requires only that they who live under its protection should demean themselves as good citizens in giving it on all occasions their effectual support. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.